Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Cantlin, CEO of Prosperity Financial Group, and I'd like to welcome you to a very exciting episode of Meet the Expert, something very different. We're going to talk financial psychology, and I know a lot of you don't even know what that is, but we'll be going over the ins and outs on this and what that means to the average person, to the average investor, to the high net worth investor, to the spouse of all those people as well, and to partners who do this as husbands and wives. What does that mean, the psychology side of it? So if you're looking to talk to us, I'm at 925-314-8503 or Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com or www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. So we're just getting ready for the dog days of the summer of this year, and it's warming up everywhere around the country. So let's see today if we can warm up our brains. Let me introduce to you our guest, Jennifer Bloodsworth. Let me tell you, she is from First Eagle Investments in Manhattan. You live in Manhattan, Jennifer?
I live right outside in Connecticut, but I am in Manhattan for work almost every day.
Good for you. I grew up in West Orange.
Oh, beautiful. So you're familiar with the area.
I am. And every time I land in Newark Airport, the first thing I do is we run, no matter, usually it's the red eye, we'll be there in a few weeks on a red eye out of San Francisco. We run first thing to White Castle and start our weekend off with hamburgers. But you got to start that if you're going to go to New York.
Yeah, it's a staple.
So welcome. And I'll tell you, she is a specialist in financial psychology. She has a master's in wealth management from Columbia. So Columbia is an Ivy League school, looks gorgeous. So it looks a little bit like a Harry Potter novel there in Harlem area of New York. So glad you survived the Harlem experience and made it to our show.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, Columbia was a great experience. Yeah, if you're ever in the city and can get up to the campus, it is just beautiful.
There you go. So let's get right into this. It's great. We really appreciate you being on with us. And let's talk about what the heck is financial psychology, mumbo jumbo. I got to lie on somebody's couch and start telling them about how my mother dropped me on my head too many times. What is financial psychology?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Financial psychology was a big piece of my master's in wealth management, actually. And it's the study of how our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors influence our financial decisions and outcomes. So think of things about like goal setting or your money attitudes and investors' financial well-being. It's related to another field, which you may have heard of, called behavioral finance. And that really looks at how biases and irrational behavior can affect financial markets. So think of things like investor sentiment or herding behavior. But basically, all of this is just a fancy way of saying that the way that we think about money affects our finances, not just as individuals, but really as a whole, and affects markets.
Okay. So as we get into the markets, because this is a financial show, and we're in a top 2.5% of all financial podcasts globally, which is really exciting. How about that?
People That's actually awesome. Want to listen Congrats. To
this in the world. So it's very good. And so we're going to end up with thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people that watch this in or listen to this in a gym or watch this at home or at work and get something out of it. And the main concept here is not just financial psychology, but the application of it to market volatility. And that's the world we live in today. And I've been doing this now for 30 years, Jennifer, and I started in 93 with the market being horrible, and then it went up, and the dot-com led the way, and then everybody told me at the end of the 90s, Elliot, it's not that the old economy is dead, and the new economy is everything, and profits mean nothing, and sales are everything, and lo and behold, 2000 showed up, and the market tanked, led by the dot-com bust, and that lasted for months, or years, I should say. And then we market went up again, and then other things happened in 2000 and, you know, in 2003 and 2007 and 8, 9 happened. And then last year happened, and I missed one or two of these things, as I'm telling you. So we have experienced a lot of volatility, and volatility from a definition standpoint is not just the market goes down, it's up and down and capitalizing on ups and downs. And I know sometimes when you capitalize on an up, some people hate that because it could be a taxable event for them, but sometimes it's way better locking your gains than worry about the taxes. And I know that's a bittersweet pill, but why don't we start with defining it and how market volatility can be your friend? And I know you're going to be coming from the financial psychology behavioral finance side of this, and then some.
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up such a great point. You know, volatility is part of any investor's life, right? So, you know, over your life in investing, you've seen ups and downs, you've seen booms and busts. And so that is something that investors, that we will all have to, you know, deal with. And like you said, volatility is both to the upside as well as to the downside. Although, you know, investors feel the pain of the downside more than they feel the joy and exuberance of the upside, studies have shown. But what volatility, in terms of thinking of volatility as your friend, volatility can create buying opportunities, meaning that when there's a drop or a pullback in the market, everything pulls back. And this can cause even some high quality companies to essentially go on sale. It's like, I like to think about, you know, when I go to the grocery store and the really fancy, expensive olive oil is on sale, I might pick up an extra bottle or two of it and feel really good about it. So similarly, when it comes to investing, we all know that we should be buying and selling high, but it turns out that that's much harder to do in practice than we might think. And so this is where financial psychology and behavioral finance enter the picture, because again, it doesn't just affect each of us on an individual basis, but it can affect us collectively and the markets.
Okay, why is that? Tell me why. And also, when you do answer that, keep in mind that we're talking to men and women, and sometimes as couples. And there's difference when they're single and they're a man or woman versus a couple, the dynamics are different. The decision-making can be more exciting and can be more fear-based. Lots of things happening. So as we answer this, why is all this so different and so complicated and convoluted? And let's make sure we throw all that stuff in there too.
Oh man. Yeah. So there's a lot of things in there that I want to unpack, Elliot. So one thing is, each of us think that the way that we think and feel about money is the way, I shouldn't say all of us think this way. Most people believe that the way that they think and feel about money is the way everyone else thinks and feels about money too. And so, especially in relationships, when someone else, when they aren't agreeing with your outlook, it can be very confusing. It can cause a lot of friction. And so there's a part of behavioral finance and financial psychology that I really love, and it is called your money scripts. And I would love to come back. You could do a whole podcast on that. I think it's a lot of times why there is conflict in relationships, because two people, once you understand someone's money script, I think it makes those conversations a lot more productive, because you have a better understanding of where that person is coming from and you have a lot more empathy for them. So that's one thing. Secondly, you're right. Our outlook, our sort of level of risk that we're willing to take, or the sort of aggressiveness that we want to be in the market, changes, you know, over the course of our life as different events have happened. You know, at one point, you know, we might be single in our 20s and we just want to invest as aggressively as we can. But, you know, when we're older, we might have, you know, we might have a shorter time horizon. We might have more responsibilities. We might want to be in more sort of a protective phase. And so it's really important for people to have open conversations with the people, you know, who are tied to them financially, whether that's your, you know, parents, spouse, children, dependents, whoever, you know, having a good conversation with them about what their needs are and what their feelings and, you know, level of comfort is with investing. But it's also really important to have those conversations with your financial advisor so that they can really understand a clear picture. And then, you know, risk isn't just market risk. There's also longevity risk. And are you investing aggressively enough to meet your goals is something that people often forget about as well. I mean, women live longer than men. They typically, their careers and their earnings, if they're in the workforce, are not as linear, I would say, as men. You know, we know that women typically earn less than men. So, you know, a lot of people assume that women are more risk averse. And there is some data to support that, but I think it's not well understood. Women are generally, women who are equally as financially educated and financially literate as men tend to have the same level of risk. The problem is, I think a lot of women are not as financially educated. And so I think it's important for women who are investing, if they are feeling fearful of the market, to have a perhaps a wider or deeper understanding of what their financial needs are, what it's going to take to reach those financial goals, and what, you know, when we talk about risk, like what does that really mean? Because it's risk is something that we've studied, and we know that it's hard for people to really conceptually understand what risk means. It's like the old saying, you know, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Well, a lot of people are aggressive investors until the market starts to get volatile, and then, you know, and then they want to pull it all out, right?
Jennifer, let me ask you a question. So when I went to Rutgers back in the Stone Age, and we took not so much psychology courses, but we took sociology and understanding the marketplace, and as an accounting and economics major here, the professor brought up an example of the different attitudes towards men and women. So this is really way before finance, or my understanding of it. And I can't remember the context it was, but the used car came up, the car purchase came up, or the used car purchase came up. And it was the example that, and I think the professor was trying to teach you how people are different and how not to fall into the stereotype. And they use this used car that when a man goes to buy a car, and we can apply this in a moment, and you know, I think it'll make sense. He gets a certain level of respect that he's a car buyer or a car shopper or whatever he is. But when a woman goes to buy the car, there becomes some type of stereotype around her that she really doesn't understand what she's doing. And I'm talking about from the car salesperson point of view, not from her point of view. And they belittle them. Then women inherently feel belittled and berated by car salespeople. And a professor was making a point to don't be a car salesperson. Don't be one of those people that treats the sexes differently, like one is smart and one is not. But understand that there is a difference between dealing with men and dealing with women. And of course, that's a big broad paintbrush. So that's not always true. But that women in general want more information and they want to know that you are listening to them and not speaking at them. Now, is that true in financial psychology, or is that just Rutgers University mumbo jumbo?
I mean, I would say that that is true. I know, you know, something else. So, you know, I'm sure that you were doing that with all of your clients. And I would encourage any women who are listening that to be involved in the financial decision. I mean, I know that you're involved in financial decisions, but when you're meeting with your financial advisor to really go in as a couple, I know I can speak, I work in finance. I'm obviously very involved in the financial planning and investing of my household. But I know with speaking with friends, you know, there's a lot to do. And so sometimes couples will really just kind of divide and conquer. And I know for a lot of my friends, it's like, you know, they don't really want to have to deal with it. And so they will kind of outsource all of those decisions to their husbands. Like they're very comfortable with that. And I've tried to encourage them that, like, even if, you know, I don't know, you find it intimidating or you aren't really that interested or you're busy, you know, please be involved in that process because number one, it does affect you. And number two, you know, your thoughts, attitudes, feelings, opinions, point of view, level of security that you need is important and you want that represented at the table. And Elliot, like you said, like, women might ask more questions and they might need more information to get to that level of comfort. And so you want to work with a financial advisor who, to your point, you know, is listening to you and is willing to take the time to answer those questions because it is important for you to understand. I mean, this is your money. This is your life. This is the money to fund your hopes and dreams and that of your children and all the things that you want to do. You know, money is not just money. It's not money for the sake of money. It's money for the things that we want to do with it.
So in emotional world, as we get in the world of emotion here, and we can skip now the difference between the sexes, because obviously men react with certain emotion, women react with certain emotion, and that's a whole course on that all by itself.
Yeah.
But I learned early on when I talked about the Rothschild Empire and that how they did so well, and that's the first investment banking family of Europe and still around today, they had this phrase that always buy when the streets are running red. And that means when everybody's running left, you want to go to the right in the investment world. When they're selling, when the masses are selling, you want to be the buyer. When the masses are buying, you want to be the seller. I think Warren Buffett had a little bit differently that he said he took a cab ride into New York City one day before the days of Uber and Lyft, and people actually took more cabs. And the cab driver didn't know who he was and started to talk to him about his stock portfolio and why he should buy more of that particular stock. And he had no idea who Warren Buffett was. And Warren Buffett realized at that moment, I got to get out because if the taxi cab driver is giving me advice, I got to run. This is bad. This is bad. Or be fearful when everybody's greedy and be greedy when everybody's fearful. It just comes up. Contrarian investing long-term can be the very big winner that just do the opposite. Of course, it doesn't always work because, again, that's the big broad paintbrush. But talk about emotional investing and what everybody's going through in their world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if you will indulge me for a moment to talk a little bit about the human brain and how the brain works, because emotion is a piece of it, but it's even more complicated than that. And I don't know if you've read the book Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Daniel Kahneman, but there's two systems in the brain. Financial psychologists believe there's two systems or way that we think in the brain. There's system one, which is the thinking fast part of the brain. And this is really the thoughts that are automatic that we cannot control. And so some of that is emotion. Some of that is memories and memorization, but these are sort of our knee-jerk thoughts that we don't even think about. So if I were to say to you, 2 + 2 = and if 4, like immediately jumps into your head, that's an example of system one, automatic thinking. If there was a intersection where you got in a car accident once and, you know, your what's called a heuristic, which is a mental shortcut that you create, is that intersection is dangerous. And so the bias that comes out of that is you might avoid that intersection on your drive. And that's just, and you don't even like really realize it, but whenever you're running to the store, you avoid that intersection. That's system one. And system one is like a marathon long distance runner. It's the Energizer Bunny. It's always running. It's always making decisions for us, which is important and we need, because otherwise, I mean, we wouldn't make it out the door in the morning if we had to make sort of these conscious, logical, heavy decisions, you know, and everything that we were doing. So system one, is always kind of in the background, taking care of a lot of things for us. System two, on the other hand, is the thinking slow part of the brain. But this is our logic center, and this is more of like a strength athlete, if you will. It's able to do like some really heavy lifting. Like if I were to say to you, you know, what's 137 times 562? You know, you have to stop and think about, okay, well, how would I break that down? That is now that system two that is working. And system two, and you might be thinking to yourself, well, great, like let's just use system two all the time. It seems to be sort of like gets me to more logical answers. The thing with both of them are great, both of them are necessary, both of them have their limitations. The system two limitation is like there's only so much it gets worn out. Like there's only so much endurance that you have. It's why if you've ever been on a diet and like you killed it at breakfast, like you did great at lunch, because system two is like, all right, I'm on a diet. This is what I'm going to eat. It's going to be healthy. And then by the end of the day, because system two has been making all kinds of decisions about family and business and everything else, by the end of the day, it is worn out. It can't make another decision. System one jumps in and says, oh, we're feeling tired and run down. So dinner tonight is ice cream. If you've ever had that experience, those are the two systems kind of working back and forth. And system one, the limitations on that is because it is taking these shortcuts. You do have these biases that build up and it leads to incomplete thinking. So how this affects us in investing, we might know buy low, sell high, but what happens is we'll get biases such as recency bias. So when the market is going up, 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 we tend to overemphasize like the recent information that we've gotten, and we will think that we can predict the future, and we'll weight that more heavily to what has just happened. So even though we cannot predict the future, since the market's been going up, 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 we will think, oh, it is more likely that it will continue to go up. And so really, as the market is becoming more and more expensive, people generally will start putting in more and more money. And then the same thing happens on the way down when the market's going down, down, down. System two says, abort, abort, it's going to keep going. And people start pulling the money out. So even though logically we know to buy low and sell high, because of recency bias and because of, you know, financial psychology, behavioral finance, what ends up happening is money goes in at the top and comes out at the bottom. We end up doing collectively as investors, we end up doing the exact opposite.
Okay, so I get it. I've been doing this long enough to know that most clients, sadly, and I love my clients, and a lot of them make bad decisions when market's going down and so forth. How do we use this information to our advantage and for clients' advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about some tactics that we can use. And let's talk about like three different scenarios. Scenario one, let's think about when you know what you should be doing, but then you have a hard time actually doing it. And so in a volatile market, you know, let's say that what you know you should be doing is to just be consistently investing into the market. So, you know, if you're familiar with dollar cost averaging, you know, the market's going to go up, market's going to go down. But if I continue to just keep buying on a regular basis, I'm going to, you know, I'll catch the down days and get some good deals. And I'm not trying to call the market, time the market at that point. And so what I would suggest is to try to automate, work with your financial advisor so that you make that decision once, and then it's automated. That way, system two, which has, you know, is very good and strong, but has limited, endurance, it can make that decision once, and then it's set it and forget it. It will, you know, come out of your checking account or what have you, move into your investment account, make those investments on a regular and timed basis, so you aren't having to make that decision on a monthly, quarterly, weekly, whatever basis. You make it once and you move on. Another scenario might be when volatility hits and you start to get antsy and you're really not quite sure what you need to do or want to do. And you start thinking about, well, my friend at the club said that, or maybe I should do this, or I heard someone on TV say something. I would say this sounds to me like an information gap. It's like system two is trying to chip in and help, but it doesn't really have all the information that it needs. And I'd say this is a great time where you can sit down with your financial advisor and get education around, you know, looking at historically what has happened, like what are the highs and lows, like what's driving the volatility right now, how long might we expect that to go for? And what should we be doing in this sort of environment? Like really work with your financial advisor to fill that information gap. And then the third scenario is where we absolutely like have a very strong feeling about what we should do. And it is something that is irrational. It is something that is not logical. And so the most common thing that we see in volatile markets is someone who wants to go from being fully invested to pulling all of their investments out into cash because they are just convinced that they can't take it anymore. The sky is falling. I need to pull everything out. And going back to, you know, our example before of, you know, this is something that happens, right? People end up buying in high. And then as this market is coming down, they sell low. And that is a behavior that we want to try to, that can lead to poor outcomes. And we want to set ourselves up for the best outcomes possible, right? So this is where I would say work with your financial advisor in more of a coaching type relationship. Your financial advisor should be able to pull up, you know, in their planning software, like, hey, let's take a look at, like, let's face that fear together. Let's look at what would happen to your portfolio if the market pulled back by 30%. And especially, I understand, you know, if you're in, say, retirement, where your assets are kind of fixed at this point, and the income that you need is a fixed amount, let's look at if the market pulled back 30%. What would that do to your income stream? Would you be able to live on that? Would we need to make adjustments in your investments or your lifestyle? Or is there something that you could sell, or would you need to go back to work? Like, let's talk about what the options are, because there are a lot of options available to you other than just let's pull everything out to cash, because you may not be able to, we talked about different risks that might set up other risks for you that you aren't thinking about. Those are some things that we can use to try to help mitigate these behavioral finance issues that can come up and really to the detriment of people's long-term financial health.
Well, we're talking with, and we're not quite done yet, but we're talking with Jennifer Bloodsworth from Connecticut, or from Manhattan, I should say, from Eagle Investments and First Eagle Investments, excuse me. We're talking about both psychology and market volatility here. I'm Elliot Callan, 925-314-8503 or www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. You know, last year, 2022, I think Americans lost or portfolios went down roughly $9 trillion. I've seen that number all over the place, but it's roughly $9 trillion. As they say, a trillion here and a trillion there, we're talking about real money. But roughly $9 trillion, and globally it went down about $30 trillion for investors around the world. This is a pretty horrible month. 2022 was a pretty horrible year in so many ways for people, and they don't realize how bad it was. And we've made some of that back, at least in the equity, in the technology field, we've made that back. But then we have a depression on every single channel being talked about, which is a negative thing. And it's like me saying to you, I just want you to know, sometime this summer, you're going to have a really big car accident. There's no upside to that statement, none at all. And so do you not drive your car anymore? Do you never do anything that's going to jump off a curb in front of a yellow or green light or a red light? Like, I mean, you're looking over your shoulder and then you end up being paralyzed with fear. And so that's the world of volatility. I just mentioned a car accident. That's personal volatility. But we live in a world of investment volatility. So with volatility being your friend, and we have markets go in and markets go out, isn't today, and I put today in quotes, because I don't mean today, I mean roughly now, if we're looking long-term, I don't need the money for 5 or 10 or 15 years. Isn't this junk conversation about depression or recession or interest rates going up or inflation going up, this is hard, isn't this a buying opportunity?
Yeah, history would say that it is, right? The future, listen, the future is unknowable. We like at First Eagle, we like to say our crystal ball is cloudy at best, right? So, you know, work with your financial advisor to build a resilient portfolio, take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of you today. And, you know, ultimately, if you are an investor, volatility is going to be part of your life, and it presents tremendous opportunity for you. You know, I think back to the 2007-2009 timeframe. In 2007, you saw this massive influx of money come into the market because for the last 3 years, the market had been up, up, up. All of this money came in. And then what happened? You had the Great Financial Recession, and all of this money flowed out by the bottom. And then you had this tremendous rebound that all of that money missed out on. If investors had just stayed invested, you know, they would have recovered and been fine. It's when you come in and pull out and you keep trying to time the market that you really do yourself a disservice.
And the message there, as we both would agree, is if you're building a portfolio for your future and long-term use, then don't think about this quarter or this year even. But that what we do at our business is, as we are both tactical and strategic. And I know that, and that's what we tell clients you should be looking for. If you're a buy and hold person, then you're just strategic. If you're selling every day, you're just tactical. At our office at Prosperity Financial Group, we're trying to be the best of that blended world of think long-term and build for this quarter and this year and adjust, look at what's going on. You know, a year ago, who would have thought that the value side of our world would have done really well? And growth would have just been, or a year and a half ago, been beaten up, but that's what happened. So everybody said going into 2023, you want to be in value, things that pay dividends, lots of cash flow, companies are really well regarded, and try to be out of everything that's growth oriented. So far, we're 5 months, 6 months into this year, it's been exactly the opposite. So you don't know, but if you're building long term, you're going to get the best of both.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. These periods of volatility are a great time to look at rebalancing, look at things that you've maybe had biases against. I know, you know, something that we talk about a lot is that, you know, the U.S. has been in favor for a very long time. But you look at historically, you know, international stocks you know, the U.S. does not have a monopoly on good quality companies. You know, there are good quality companies all around the world. And just because the U.S. has been in favor for a long time, like, that does not necessarily mean that it always will be. So, you know, periods of volatility are a great time. Sit with your financial advisor, look at your portfolio, examine your levels of risk, examine your goals. What is it you're trying to do? Is your portfolio properly positioned for that? Where have there been pockets of outperformance and underperformance that you might want to rebalance? That's what you should be doing during these times.
And you're with First Eagle, and I know First Eagle is very much a globally based company. So you're looking at opportunities anywhere.
Exactly. We're really looking for, you know, high quality companies regardless of where they exist.
So on that note, before we end, let me just ask you a question on the global front. Right now, we live in a war. There's a Ukrainian war out there that's not going away anytime soon. And even if it comes to an end tomorrow, there's going to be $1 trillion or more that's going to have to go in there to rebuild it, which is an opportunity, by the way, for investors. There's a general hatred and mistrust for anything that is Russian today. And then China has been eating our lunch and cleaning our clock for years, and more people are now aware of it and worried about, for me, with children and grandchildren, are they going to go to war one day with China? How do we navigate that?
Well, I would say from the First Eagle perspective, just going back to the future is unknowable. There are certainly these large macroeconomic issues that we're looking at. But we really start with, looking across the world and trying to find high quality companies that are stable, that have some level of scarcity, basically that they have, they are protected or defensive against being disrupted. And so we look for that first, then we try to buy them at a really attractive price. And then we also have some cash and gold in our portfolios in order to be defensive. Because the thing about, our global value team has been around for 40 years. So they've certainly seen many, many different market cycles. And then we as a firm have been around for 150 years. So we have had to be resilient through all kinds of macroeconomic issues, we'll say. And what has gotten us through as a company is by being in a position where we are, again, I'll just come back to that word resilient, that you don't know what is coming, after you crash the car, it's too late to go back and get insurance, right? So it's like having a well-diversified and protected portfolio while at the same time looking for opportunities is certainly, I would say, our philosophy and our outlook.
Well, I want to thank you for being part of today's show. We've been talking about Jennifer Bloodsworth. You've listened to her for the last half hour. It's been very interesting. Basically, the concept here is volatility is your friend, not your enemy. And the market goes down, that's an opportunity. Market goes up, that's an opportunity to earn more profits rather than, oh my goodness, I need to run for the hills before there's nothing left and the stock market goes to zero. There's opportunity here. And that's what we've been talking about. And we've been talking about the financial psychology that's used here that so many people, unlike, when your sweater goes on sale that you want to buy and you run to store and you buy it on sale and you're excited. For some reason, when stocks go down, the market psychology is get me out of here. And you want to be the opposite of that, the contrarian that says, wow, is this a time for a good opportunity? Or should I still wait for it to go down? But I don't want to miss the up. So that's what market psychology is. And you've done a great job talking about it. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was wonderful.
And we'll see everybody again on another episode of Meet the Expert. Have a great day, everyone.